Okay. And welcome back to the Manic Manor podcast. This is Mitchie. And today's episode, I have a special guest sitting in here with me. He's going to talk a little bit and help me get through this episode because it's a hot and heavy one. We are going to talk about Unit 731 in Japan. You want to say hi?
Hi, everyone. My name is Brian. I'm excited to be a part of this episode.
Awesome. So we're just going to go ahead and we are going to dive in. I am equipped with dog. So if you hear some snuffing, it is a emotional support dog. So we're going to start talking about Unit 731. You have to talk about the man who was behind it because he pretty much was by all definitions an evil genius. That man is known as Chiro Ishii. Isn't quite as known as many of the other World War II war crime, criminals. So Ishii was born June 25th, 1892. While they don't know exactly which location he was born in, they do kind of agree on a consensus that he was born in the Chiba Prefecture in Japan. He was the fourth son of a wealthy landowner and sake manufacturer, so he came from a considerably noble background, didn't really know the definition of struggling. And while he was growing up, he was also growing up within the Meiji Restoration in Japan. Anybody who is familiar with the Meiji Restoration knows this is when, like, the royals in Japan pretty much took back control from the shogunates, and they modernized, essentially. They took military modernization to a new level. So this led Chiro to become a stone-cold nationalist and was dedicated to the improvement of Japan as a nation. And because of his upbringing being noble as well, it instilled in him a class system. And we're going to see his belief that, you know, there were people who were far superior than others later on down the line. Chiro, growing up, he was extremely smart. In fact, I would say he was way too smart for his own good. And he was also very tall, taller than a lot of his peers. I think they said he stood about 5'10" compared to some of his other classmates as well as his siblings. Smarter than schoolmates, smarter than siblings. It was said that he could memorize entire textbooks with a photographic memory. So with that, he was very power hungry for knowledge, not just knowledge in itself, but power hungry in general. Like, he wanted to be the top dog. He saw relationships that he developed as simply a means to an end. Everything was pretty much superficial for him. If it didn't benefit him in any way, then he didn't necessarily give a shit about it. So many of the classmates that spoke about him in later years said that they felt like any kind of friendship that they created with him wasn't really a deep connecting relationship. So after grade and high school years, he entered into Kyoto Imperial University, which is now just Kyoto University, and was very much a brown noser. So there was the university president at the time, Torasaburo Araki. Chiro was said to break decorum. So I don't know how it is in Korea. How is it when it comes to, you know, superiors when you're in education?
They have the absolute authority over you in terms of how you're educated and the curriculum. I think it's mostly very prevalent in Asian country where the education curriculum is pretty strict. No, not as lenient as here in U.S. And I'm sure it was even more strict back then in these days in Japan.
Imperial Japan, yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, when it comes to relationships with your teachers, would you say that that was considered normal for Japan in Korea and all that? Do you think that was something that was normal or something that was very out of the ordinary for him to do?
I think it's very common in any country trying to build a relationship with your teacher or professor. I think that's
so
common. Yep.
You think so? You don't think, like, they thought that it was like a breach of decorum? Like, oh, you, like, this person is higher up. Why are you talking to him like you're an equal?
I don't think so. Maybe the part about talking to them in equal, but I'm sure he had different intentions than just building a relationship with a professor. I think he was trying to take advantage of that,
I
as
think
we've heard. Yep.
Yeah. I think so too. Like he was very power hungry, and I know I sent you the notes and everything to read on. The brown nosing that he did with Araki actually resulted in him getting extremely close with Araki's daughter. And around the time that he graduated from Kyoto Imperial University for the first time in the, I think it was like 1920, he married Araki's daughter. So a lot of people, I think, looked at that like, oh, okay, yeah, he's definitely trying to build up a decorum for himself, build up this reputation that's prestigious. But maybe he did actually care for her because they did have quite a few children. One of the children that's talked about frequently is his daughter, Harumi, and she's going to be like his number one defender later on down the line. But I don't see how she could, knowing what we know now about him. So, going on in the same year after he had graduated from Kyoto, he went into the army instead of going into a private practice like most of his graduating peers.
You know why he did that? Why did he choose to join the army instead of private practice?
I think if he went into a private practice, just judging off of what I studied about him, it wouldn't have he wouldn't have had a greater impact as far as, military influence goes, even though doctors are very prestigious and their word should be taken quite seriously, especially if they're trying to better a country. I think he thought if he was a doctor within the military itself, he would be taken more seriously. That is, that's just what I think.
Okay.
So he was assigned to the First Army Hospital and Army Medical School, and while he was assigned here, he was still trying to push, for the advancement of Japan, like a lot of the nationalists of that time were doing. He did a lot of studies, a lot of research, and quite a bit of work. And the work that he did impressed a lot of the supervisors that were above him. And this prompted him to actually go back to Kyoto to get his PhD in 1924. And because, he had all these recommendations from his superiors. He had, he was good with the university president at the time. He was prompted a lot of research opportunities that a lot of people who were getting their doctorate would not have gotten. There was a thing where he had traveled to an island that was like infected with this brain. It was like brain inflammation of some something. He got to go there and study and work to cure that. And he became obsessed with pathology. It was said that he was even rumored to go into the lab and grow bacteria and keep them as pets. And he would spend hours upon hours every night in these science rooms with these bacteria pets. And it pissed off a lot of his peers because, at the end of the day, when you're doing science and you have to have all these test tubes, the beakers, the what do you call them? The microscopes that you look into?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he was dirtying them after they had cleaned them, and he wouldn't clean them afterwards. Like they would come back in, and the whole thing would be dirty, and it would piss him off.
I'm surprised the school even allowed him to have quote-unquote bacteria pets. That's interesting.
I think it was because he was so higher up. There was this class system of, oh, you are a noble. I'm somebody who is beneath. So a lot of people, I feel like they would have been afraid to say shit. Like they would have been afraid that it repercussions would have come down on them. So he did all of this, and in 1927, he actually did get his PhD. He became a doctor, and he was still in the army at this time. He ranked up to Army Surgeon Second Class. And after graduation, he continued his research. And during all this research that he did, he stumbled across a report from the 1925 Geneva Convention. And in this report, they were talking about, how biological warfare that had been used quite heavily in World War I, with the chemicals and all that, how it was banned because of that. So he had a thought in his head. It had already been there, but looking through this report, it gave him the idea that biological warfare was a necessity, especially because, the other nations came together and said, yeah, we need to ban it. And he was going to propose an idea to military officials that they should use it because, if they're trying to ban it, odds are they're trying to use it themselves and they're keeping it hush hush. Now, the initial leadership in the military at that time dismissed dismissed him, but he still set out to pursue a 2-year world tour to gather information in hopes to persuade these military leaders that they would be able to, utilize biological weapons, that if they did not, they were going to be left behind. So he went all around the world. He went to like Germany. He went to, I think he went to France. He definitely went to the United States. I know that for sure. He was in like all, like a lot of the major cities, like DC, Los Angeles, New York, and would meet with, public government type of scientists. And he would also meet with private practicing scientists as well. And he was gathering his findings. So he did all this. Like I said, he was out there for about 2 years and returned home. And when he returned home, there were new military leaders. And when he presented these findings to these leaders, they were way more than happy to accept the findings. So he got a lot of support from people like General Sadao Araki and Tetsuo Nagata, or Nagata. And another notable person that he got support from was Colonel Koizumi. Now, Nagata, he was rumored to be Ishii's greatest supporter. In fact, he supported him so well that even after Nagata had passed, Ishii had a bust of him in his office at Unit 731. And this allowed Ishii, with all of this support that he had, to rise in the ranks really fast. And he was able to promote theories that he had to other higher ranking officials. So he was like getting into the cracks and crevices and getting under their skin and just like planting these little seeds. So he was gaining power really fast. So he was given so much, in fact, that he actually got a head chair at the Department of Immunology at the Tokyo Army Medical College. So he was teaching as well as doing research. And given quite a lot of government funds from Japan to study in biological warfare and teach these students to develop diseases. And they were very focused on things like anthrax and the bubonic plague just in this college. So the research that he did aided him in collecting more funds because, he would publish these papers, get funds, get like dividends from the papers he was posting, and that would allow him to research further. So, with his charm and all of his smarts, he convinced pretty much a good chunk of the population that was around him that they were going to eventually have to do human experimentation. Like, he thought that in order to properly study how biological warfare could be done, they would have to have humans. So, this meant they weren't going to necessarily, experiment on their own people. No. This meant collecting those that these nationalistic people believed were beneath them, people who were not pure of Japanese blood. What you want to say about that?
I guess they had similar ideas as Hitler back then.
Oh, yeah. We saw that with Adolf Hitler, the Nazi Party looking down on Jews and gypsies, gay people. Like, definitely what they did with the Jewish population during World War II, but a lot's not talked about, the Romani and the Gypsy populations as well. So anybody was fair game if they weren't pure Japanese blood. So I gotta say this, Japan decided that they were going to invade Manchuria. Manchuria, the northeast part, it's the northeast part in China, correct?
I'm not sure, but I think so.
Yeah, so Ishii had a lot of I don't want to say motivation, I want to say like influence. He had a lot of influence in this. I mean, they already wanted to invade Manchuria because that area was rich in like all sorts of I don't even know the word that I want to use for that. I mean, it had a lot of resources that they were going to need. And they were feeling like they felt like they needed to take this over because of how close it was in proximity to Russia. And at this time, Russia, communism, Soviet Union, there was that scare. So they didn't want, other Asian nations, quote unquote, being influenced by communism. So this led to 1931. think it was 1931 actually, where they invaded Manchuria. And once they had this land to themselves, Ishii had written that they were going to need to begin human experimentation. So don't let Japan tell you that they, as a government, did not know that this was going on. They knew. So now we're getting into the nitty-gritty. So, like I said, we talked about how Nazi Germany inflicted a great deal of damage on the world with the Holocaust, the crimes they committed. Not a lot of people talk about what Japan did. So we're going to go in there and we're going to talk about that. So Japan invaded Manchuria September 18th, 1931. The invasion was a result of the Japanese, quote unquote, blaming Chinese nationalists. Hey, look, nationalists. Isn't that funny? They're saying Chinese nationalists are a problem here. Meanwhile, they wanted to better themselves, and they were doing the same thing. So they were blaming them for the Mukden incident. And you know about the Mukden incident, don't you?
Yes, yep.
Yeah. So they blamed Chinese nationalists, and there was this explosion near a railway track in Mukden City. A lot of speculation now is that it actually had nothing to do with Chinese nationalists, but rather Japanese officers in the army creating that to gain an advantage to further invade. And there was little resistance from the Chinese army due to the army in China not being as trained as Japan was at the time. So they took Manchuria. The area then became known as Manchukuo and was under Japanese control, as well as the entirety of the Korean Peninsula. So they had a good chunk of land. So during this time in the early 1930s, while occupying Manchuria, Japan began to really go deep diving into developing biological weapons. So Japan saw the ban, like I said, as a means that they were super effective, and therefore they had to use them. So we're in 1932 now. Chiro Ishii is a general. He was also chief medical officer of the Imperial Army, and he was placed in command of a group that they officially named in the government as the Army Epidemic Prevention Research Laboratory. During this, there was the Second Sino-Japanese War. So this is happening way before World War II actually started. There was the Marco Polo Bridge incident. You want me to tell you about that because it's kind of funny. So the Marco Polo Bridge incident, there was a Japanese soldier that didn't return to his post. And Japan thought, okay, China has taken our soldier. They used it as an excuse to push further in. They were looking for their soldier and said, "Hey, we want our soldier." And of course, China was like, "No, you can't come further in. We didn't do nothing to your soldier." And I'm sure you can imagine what happened as a result of that. The private that they were looking for turned up. And you want to know the excuse that he gave?
What is it?
He had a stomach ache and had to go to the bathroom.
Oh, wow.
I think he ate one too many grapes. So yeah, he said he got turned around on his way back to his barracks, and it led to a massive blowout between Japan and China. So just in the Second Sino-Japanese War, there were a lot of atrocities that were committed. A very notable one that I am so glad is actually getting more recognition now is what happened in Nanking. And in that incident in and of itself is so massive that it's going to need its own episode to talk about. So Japan was not, this big brother nation that was looking out for their other nations. No, they were committing horrible acts against people of their own race, essentially, because they believed that they were the superior race. A minimum of like tens of thousands of lives were lost just in this one massacre alone, done by the Japanese army. For the longest time, that was kept in the dark, and we will talk about that on a later time. But all of this leads to the formation of what is known as the Togo Unit, which is the starting grounds for Unit 731. It's also the the Army Epidemic Prevention Research Laboratory that we had mentioned earlier, Togo Unit. It had a whole bunch of different names. It was like, quote unquote, a subgroup of this research team, and they had named it after General Hideki Togo. So the responsibility of the Togo Unit was to research and develop biological and chemical warfare, but they disguised it as a logging facility. So a lot of people who know about Unit 731 know about Pingfang, which was a gigantic city in and of itself. But there was an area before Pingfang known to the locals in the Manchuria area as Zhangma Fortress. This was the start. It was essentially a camp that was for nothing more than just human experimentation. Located in an area called Bianhe, which was a small village, they completely wiped this area out and ran the locals out of there to make this camp. They used Chinese laborers to build this camp, and those laborers that built the camp would then be executed after they were done, or after the Japanese army deemed them to be done with the job, because they could have no survivors talking about what was going on here.
Wow, that is so barbaric.
Yeah, and that's just the workers. We're not getting in to talk about what actually happened on the inside. It's really fucked up. So this was a massive building. It was a prison camp, essentially. Like I said, it was surrounded by a moat, loaded up with barbed wires that were electrified. And the place was made, like I said, on Chinese labor and prison labor as well. So prisoners that were in that area, anybody who was taken to Zhangma, they didn't get out, with the exception of a select few. And that select few that did escape is the reason why Zhangma was destroyed and Pingfang was created. So we'll talk about that. So, like I said, they used the excuse that this was nothing more than a wood mill. I don't see why a wood mill would need to have a moat and electrified barbed wire. But they said it was nothing more than a wood mill, and they were simply hoarding logs. Who do you think those logs actually were?
Probably people, right?
They were people. A lot of the people there, it was mainly like Chinese prisoners of war, people they deemed criminals. And there were some Russians in the area that had lived there because during this time, Russia, Soviet Union is what they were known as at the time, had a small population that lived there that worked for the railway that had been there at one point. So, what they did was the people that came in here that they brought in, they were fed a fairly decent diet. They were given like fish, some meats, you know, hearty grains of rice, and even alcohol. It was a ruse. It was trying to get these people back up to like peak optimal health, and then that's when they would begin their experimentations. And this happened in Pingfang as well. It was the same pattern that they used. So the first step in a twisted set of experiments was to see if they could get the body to a healthy stage before subjecting it to extreme bouts of torture. So during this time, the prisoners would be subjected to tons of bacteria, such as, like I said, the bubonic plague. That was one of their favorites. Cholera, anthrax, you name it, they subjected them to it. They would be starved, dehydrated. They would drain them just about of all of their blood, pretty much to the bare minimum that you could have in your body without it killing you. And they would also inject them with blood from horses, just to see how they would react. They would leave them out to the elements. So what they would do is they would dip their bodies in, you know, these tubs of water, leave them there until they were shivering, pull them out, and then take them out in like the extreme cold winter air when it was winter during the time, and see how long it would take them to develop frostbite. And when they did develop frostbite, they would bring them in, splash them with like, you know, boiling hot water to thaw them out. Sometimes they would just take sticks and tap on their arms or like smack their arms to see what would happen. Not only that, a lot of them would be injected with certain diseases. a favorite that they loved to do was a lot of venereal diseases. So they would have somebody come in that was clearly infected with a sexually transmitted disease. This is a trigger warning. So if you are, very squeamish or you've gone through something involving SA, I would skip forward a little bit. They would force them to commit sexual acts on one another or just straight up rape other prisoners. And if they didn't agree to do that, then they would shoot them right there on the spot. But yeah, they would have them do all of those vulgar acts. Even some of the officers themselves would be doing the rapes. And they would impregnate these women that were there. And the women, they would get these diseases from these people who had obviously had them. And they would vivisect people. They would cut them open to see just what it would do to, like, the fetus that was within the woman, as well as the people themselves. And not only that, they would just straight up decide, if they had them out to the elements, with the frostbite, they would cut their arms off. And once they were done with that, they would just kill the person on the table. That is only a tiny little bit of what went on in Unit 731. And that's just, like I said, that's just the beginning. So it's a lot. So remember how I said that there were a few people that did manage to get out of Zhangma?
Yeah.
So with that, it was like 1934, and it was a holiday for Japan. There was a small prison break that went down during this holiday, and it was raining that day. I think there was like 16 prisoners that managed to escape in general because they were able to get past some of the guards because the guards were like blackout drunk. Now, even though there were 16 prisoners that did manage to escape, there was a lot more that tried to aid in, getting out of there. But the few that were cognizant, talking about the Japanese soldiers, shot them dead. Like they were making this human chain trying to get up the fence and trying to get out. And only like a handful of them was able to get out successfully. So there were technically survivors of Unit 731, but I don't think they managed to survive that long considering the torture just on what we spoke of here.
That is so tragic.
I know. But those people that did manage to survive, I had heard that a lot of them ended up joining, like, Chinese resistance. And that's how rumors of Unit 731 initially got out. So, Zhangma, they ended up having to close it. Quote unquote, they said it was just an explosion, like a freak accident that had happened, but that's not what it was. They completely just demolished the building because they didn't want people finding out what was going on. So they relocated to another facility in Pingfang, and this was at a much larger scale. I'm talking major, like it was a town within itself. It had a school for children of the officers and the scientists and the doctors and all that. It had a theater because for some reason, I guess they needed to be entertained. Had their own farms for them to sustain themselves. So in 1936, Togo Unit went under a guide the new guidance of the Imperial Army after Emperor Hirohito authorized them to be integrated into the Kwantung Army. And they kind of split it in two. They split it into the Ishi Unit and the Wakamatsu Unit. This led to the name change to what a lot of people know it as the Epidemic Prevention and Water Purification Department of the Kwantung Army, or Unit 731 for short. A lot easier than having to say that first name. So the
Definitely.
yeah, so the unit now had when they started had about 300 researchers that included bacteriologists and doctors, had a much bigger staff as well, and this was located somewhere in Harbin. The area had over 150 buildings. Each building was designated for something. This is just talking about the experimentation. They had produ building for producing chemicals, building for producing various agents, buildings for their human studies. a lot. So in this place, they would raise fleas containing the bubonic plague because that was still one of their favorites. I think they said somewhere it was like close to 5,000 containers just of infected fleas that they had. 5,000 containers in this one unit. And the Unit 731 in Pingfang was not the only Unit 731. It was spread throughout Asia. There was Unit 731 in places like Singapore, other places in China. I wouldn't be surprised if there was one close to Korea because, Japan had occupied Korea at this time.
But
So,
none in Japan mainland, right?
none in the mainland of Japan, no. And I think you can speculate why that was.
Yeah, to avoid the blame.
Right, they could easily pass the blame on and be like, oh no, you see, it was the Chinese, it was the Koreans. See, they did all this. I feel like that's what they would have done had they not gotten caught in the long run. So many prisoners would be brought in. They still stuck to the name that it was a lumber mill. Maruta, I think, is what they call them. What did you learn about it in Korea? Because I know you told me that you had learned about the log thing.
In Korea, this is a like an urban legend, but people that are in the organ harvesting, that crimes, they refer to human bodies as logs in Korea. The Korean term for log is tongnamu, and they call it a log business called tongnamujangsa. This is like an urban legend, so I think this came from the initial 731's terminology, which is a little ironic.
It's funny that it was an urban legend because, urban legends are usually meant to scare the living shit out of you. And so it comes from a little bit of truth, as we see here. It came from Unit 731, clearly. So they brought in a ton of people. They brought in the Chinese, the few Russians that they had. They definitely had brought in Koreans. That is something that has been verified. There's a photo of a Korean victim. He was a young man. I think he was actually my age at the time that they had captured him. And that's just one confirmed photo. It's proven that there was a lot of Korean individuals that were taken. It was mainly Chinese and Koreans that were experimented on. But they also brought in prisoners of war, such as American prisoners of war. There was a lot of people that had worked there when it came to light, finally, what happened with 731 that had talked about it and said, oh, yeah, we saw these soldiers. So life expectancy was slim to none. If you were lucky, you maybe had a year to live in that prison. That's if you were the more fortunate one, mainly if you were one of the women that they took in simply for the fact of impregnating, just so they could experiment on babies. These people, much like Zhang Ma, were subjected to horrid experimentation that the researchers that did it took this information and would publish it. But here's the thing, when they were publishing these findings, they never admitted what their test subjects were. They implied that it was done on monkeys. They never said it was humans. They would always say, oh, it was either long-tailed monkeys or Manchurian monkeys. So that kind of says what they thought about anybody who was not pure Japanese at the time. Couldn't be further from the truth. It was not monkeys, it was humans. The truth was, there was over like 600 people at any given time that they would hold for these experiments. These people were subjected to some of the most grotesque things that you can think of just in the name of science. And sometimes it was said that a lot of time, not a lot of times, but sometimes it was just for sick gain, just because they enjoyed doing what they were doing. Women that were taken in, as I said before, they were raped, forced to carry these pregnancies while also being subjected and exposed to venereal diseases. They would be vivisected while pregnant, and anybody who knows vivisection knows that they're doing this without any kind of anesthesia. So they felt everything that was happening to them. And they said the reason that they did this was because they wanted to see the effects that the diseases would have on the mother and the fetus. as well as the men that they would vivisect that were subjected to like the plague and all that. They just wanted to see what it was. One of their favorite venereal diseases that they liked to use when they were in Ping Fong was syphilis. The guards would joke that this is really gross. The guards there, you know how I told you about the vagina jokes that they did? So women who were infected, the guards would say, "Oh, look at this. They have jam-filled buns."
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
Wow.
I got sick to my stomach looking at that and reading about it. But now, when the women gave birth, if they did, because let's face it, a lot of these women, the fucking hell that they had to go through, they probably ended up losing these pregnancies quite a bit. But the few that were able to give birth, they didn't get any kind of bonding time with their children. The infant would be pretty much taken away and would experience the same type of experimentation. There was one case where they tested to see how long infants could last by themselves in the elements. 3 days. They deduced that it was 3 days.
And these were newborns, right? Just out of
Newborns.
the mom's. Oh my gosh.
Newborn kids.
That is heartbreaking.
I know. Men and women alike, didn't matter what your age was, what your status was. They would tie them up outside to like wooden poles, and they would take weapons such as grenades and throw the grenades at them from various points to see the effect of the grenades on the human body. They also enjoyed using knives and bayonets to see the effects of them on the human body as well. And you know what a bayonet is, right?
Yeah, those really long knives that you attach to those
Yeah, to the gun. So
guns. Yep.
they would like shoot at them and like stab them with a bayonet just to see how it would act, like how they would react.
That is so gruesome.
Yeah. Limbs, like I said, sticking them into the ice water until frozen, or they would just straight up leave them out in the elements until the frostbite process began. And then they would amputate them, no anesthetic, just straight up chop them off. And then sometimes for fun, they would beat the affected limbs with sticks. There were tons of cases of anyone who went in there, they would be electrified and gassed. And we know about gassing. We know what Nazi Germany did to a lot of the Jewish people who went to places like Treblinka and Auschwitz. They would gas them, like in masses. They were doing the same thing in Japan and Manchuria. They were doing the same thing.
I wonder if Germany did it prior to Japan, or if Japan did it first at Germany.
I don't know. I mean, I see where, like we talked about, it was like the second Sino-Japanese War where a lot of Unit 731 started to really develop. So I think it's quite a possibility that maybe because Germany and Japan were technically allies with each other during the war, that they were taking ideas off of one another. So yeah. And not only that, they had a, I think they call it a hyperbaric chamber, where they would put prisoners in this chamber and turn the pressure up in the chamber until their eyes popped out of their sockets, just to see the effects of like implosion and high pressure in confined areas. The food that they were fed was poisoned with a lot of diseases and chemicals. They had children there that they would feed poisoned rice. They gave transfusions of horse blood once again. And this wasn't, they didn't just do things within the fortress. They actually did things to the surrounding areas, the surrounding villages. One thing that they did a lot was unleash those plague-infused fleas into the neighboring Chinese villages. And after the fleas had, ran their thing and, the bubonic plague took over, they would see the outcome of it. We know what happened during the Black Death in, medieval Europe. And these villages in China at the time, they were so remote and scarce that they didn't have any kind of proper medical equipment to treat these things. So they pretty much just died gruesome, awful, pus-filled deaths.
So they
And
wiped out an entire village just for
not,
their co experiment, huh?
yeah, and not just one village. They wiped out many, many villages. They also
Goodness.
would, here's the sick and tw here's another sick, twisted, fucked up thing, because a lot of shit that Imperial Japan did was very fucked up. This is just fucking sadistic. So they would unleash viruses, right? It would infect these cities. Chinese government, the local Chinese government in the area would be desperate, so fucking desperate to take care of it, to take care of their people. And Japan, their army, would come in and be like, oh, we have this vaccine. If you let us come in here and give all these people vaccines, we'll help you. So they were pretending to help them while also simultaneously fucking obliterating them. Those vaccines that they gave these people were not vaccines to treat these viruses. If anything, it exacerbated their viruses or gave them new ones. And the local Chinese governments were just so desperate to help their citizens, they felt like they didn't have a choice. And they were completely in the dark about what was happening until their people were dropping like flies.
This is so heartbreaking.
And I know it's rough. So going on, one worker, they named him as Wano, or however you want to pronounce his name. That's pretty much an alias that was given to him. Claimed that while he worked there, he saw a lot of this stuff going down. One particular story that he talked about was a Russian man. This is rough. He said that it appeared to be Westerner, possibly from the Soviet Union. He was vivisected. He ended up passing, and what they did with his body was they cut it up and put it in formaldehyde and essentially pickled him. So that was just that's just a fraction of what we know happened at this place. It said Shiro Ishii only released like 80% of his studies, and this is just, from word of mouth of people who were willing to talk about what had happened. So we probably don't even know the full effect of what had happened. But I can tell you this, if you thought that the Japanese people themselves were safe from these experimentations, they weren't. If you were a worker there and you were Japanese, and you just happened to, come in contact with the bubonic plague or come in contact with a nasty virus, you were subjected to the same thing too, because you were expected to lead to the betterment of your nation. It's on record too. There was a worker who worked along with a lot of other people in developing these fleas with the bubonic plague, and he got infected. It was said that he was once this lively guy who loved to drink, he loved to party, but he ended up getting sick and developing sores and fell really thin with no appetite. And the unit, instead of helping him, just decided that this was a means to further research. And he was spared no mercy and met the same fate as the people that he was experimenting on himself. It was said that his last words was to his own co-workers, calling them bastards. So these experiments, they continued pretty much to the very end of the war. And when I say the end of the war, I'm talking about the end of when, Japan was involved. So, Japan, they attacked the US, they dropped the bombs on Pearl Harbor. We know what happened as a result of Pearl Harbor. A lot of people don't know that Ishii had plans to use weapons against the US and things that came to be known as Operation Cherry Blossoms at Night. And that was where they were going to take, plague-infested fleas and unleash them in, I think it was San Francisco. But Japan surrendered before they could do that, and that was because, the United States had come in with the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, towards the end, when the United States and the Red Army, the Soviet Union, were closing in, primarily the Red Army that was closing in, it was evident that Japan was losing. And they couldn't risk having the exposure of what they had done come to light. They couldn't risk these heinous activities being known. So any remaining prisoners that were left in Unit 731 were killed on site. They were either poisoned or they were just execution style shot. It was done to conceal any and all evidence. So far as we know, there are no documented survivors from Pingfang's Unit 731. 1945, like I said, with the army closing in, Unit 731 pretty much just had to halt all their activities on a dime. If there was any kind of incriminating material, such as papers or the buildings themselves, they destroyed them. No witnesses, no papers, no building. Ishii ordered his men that this would be a secret that they would have to take to their graves. They were given cyanide vials, and the workers were told that if they were captured by, the Soviets or by the Americans, that they were to kill themselves on the spot as a thing to keep everything quiet, as a way to preserve the pride of Japan as a nation. And that's not the only thing that they did. They did one last act of just pure fucking terrorism. And you want me to tell you what that was?
Sure, go ahead.
They infected horses with Glanders disease and released them into the nearby villages. And they also released plague-infected rats. So they were just like, you know what? Fuck you. We're gonna go out with a bang. And they unleashed all this shit. So naturally, it was a mass loss of life and a lot of innocent people that were taken as a result of this. Just not even counting what happened at Unit 731. At a minimum, by the end of Ishii's reign of terror, 500,000 plus people were confirmed to be dead as it was linked to what had happened.
Oh my gosh.
That doesn't account for personal deaths caused directly by Ishii or other members, doesn't count for deaths that were never properly documented. Even today, those numbers are still continuously increasing. So, a skeleton crew was left after all the other soldiers had abandoned this unit. Skeleton crew, just the bare minimum that they could use to demolish these buildings, blew up what they could. Although there's still shells of these buildings left. De I know there's definitely a couple of buildings that are still left in Manchuria. So they thought that they had gotten away with it. And honestly, they kind of fucking did, and that's what pisses a lot of people off. you may wonder why Japan really didn't get punished for it, and I'm gonna tell you. I always like to say the United States is not a hero, it's an anti-hero at best. The US gave Japan immunity. By that, I mean General Douglas MacArthur and President Truman approved immunity, this immunity deal for Japanese individuals that were captured, because Hiro Ishii himself was captured by the Americans. They said, okay, here's the deal. We will tell you this, like Japan was saying, we will tell you this in exchange for that. Don't put us on trial. Don't sentence us for what we did. And they came to an agreement with that. So while they did have a trial in the US talking about the war crimes and stuff that was committed, they made a point to not really talk about Unit 731. Apparently, according to Lieutenant Colonel Murray Sanders, who had actually recommended this deal, he said the knowledge gained from these heinous acts was a small price to pay.
Let's see if Koreans, Chinese, and all those surrounding countries agree with that small price to pay.
I don't
That
think
is.
they I don't think they do even to this day. I'll also note that the United States, they weren't in the dark about this. They weren't completely oblivious. They had their suspicions. So for a while they were kind of aware that Japan was doing things because there were Japanese doctors who would be over in the US during this wartime. And these doctors would slip up. Like they would be found just like either bragging about stuff or they would be found trying to bribe their way into gaining things like yellow fever stocks from a technician at the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research. And that was verified that they had found Japanese doctors trying to bribe their way and get things. It became even further confirmed when the US took cha Japanese prisoner of wars. And these prisoners, they weren't that very nationalistic because they sang like a canary when they were taken in and being, interrogated. They broke fairly easy, and so the US was kind of aware of what was going on. And that's how they found out about like Operation Cherry Blossoms at Night, and such, and furthermore. So that wasn't to say that because they got this, plea deal that pretty much allowed them to run away scot-free, that some of them didn't get some sort of punishment. Because keep in mind, the Soviets had captured some Japanese people as well. And they did a trial as well. I don't know how you properly pronounce it, but I think it was the Khabarovsk War Trial. They did end up convicting, I think it was 12 Unit 731 members. And those members were sentenced from anywhere from 2 to 25 years at a Siberian labor camp. Most of them ended up serving way less than what they were actually sentenced. I think the most I saw somebody actually serve, I think, was maybe 9 or 10 years. And I think this was probably because, just like with the US, the Japanese exchanged findings for some sort of leniency. So the US entered their plea deal with Japan. The crimes committed were swept under the rug in the US. And of course, during this time, the United States also was designated in helping Japan rebuild after the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So it seemed like with all of that, that Unit 731 would have been lost to the world. It was pretty much as if Ishii and his men got off scot-free with just a slap on the wrist. They had immunity from trials, judges were misled. Ishii got to host parties alongside high-ranking US officials. He never actually saw a prison cell. He mingled with a lot of higher-ups in DC.
That's just crazy.
I think it's fucking disgraceful, honestly. I understand that the US decided that we needed that information that they had done, and unfortunately, a lot of our medical research today probably has some sort of thanking to what had happened. And I hate that so fucking much. Shiro Ishii even got a job working with the US government. And so the US citizens were kept in the dark about what had happened. And like I said, he only unleashed, like released about 80% of his information. Ishii knew that if he kept the American government, trying to poke and want more of this information, that he had a one up. Like he was safe from being thrown in the jail because what would happen to him if the US knew 100% of what had happened? They wouldn't have any use for him anymore. So, yeah, he was pretty much like one-upping his way even to the very end. Now, in the 1950s, rumors started to circulate about what happened at Unit 731. Rumors were surfacing. And here is what I found out. It seemed like there was still human experimentation that was being done. There was a death at Nagoya City Pediatric Hospital. And when they looked into it and investigated, the culprits that were tied to it were former Unit 731 members. And it was like from there, it was like a snowball effect. Everything just kept rolling. There were rumors of 731 ties to places, like experiments that were being done in Fukuoka as well. There was a blood bank that came under fire when there was 3,000 Japanese people who ended up contracting HIV. And books started to be published, and articles started to be published, and it was like piece by piece, it was starting to come out what had actually happened. Then in the 80s, a individual named Ken Yuasa gave testimony about what happened in China as far as human vivisection went. So Japan as a government, do you think they really took accountability for what happened?
I am very certain that they never did, and even to this day, they still have not.
They didn't take any kind of accountability. So they denied any wrongdoing for the longest time, but former workers of Unit 731 started to come forward. They eventually would admit in 1988 that they recognized what happened, but like I said, recognize there was no accountability and there definitely was not an apology. So many lawsuits were filed against Japan for these crimes. There was a lawsuit that was in 2002 with the Tokyo District Court, accepting the fact that Unit 731 had waged germ warfare. But while they accepted that claim, they also dismissed the plaintiffs who were Chinese. It was China. They dismissed their request for compensation for what had happened. And this was one of the very few times that Japan admitted that the Imperial Army had done any such crime. So to this day, it's just unclear how much responsibility Japan will actually take as a nation. Nowadays, there are a lot of Japanese who are coming to recognize what had happened, but at the same time, there's a lot of Japanese individuals who completely dismiss it and blow it under the rug. They definitely do so with the acts that were committed in Korea as far as like Korean comfort women go. I think you told me of a Japanese government official who just said that they had volunteered.
Yeah, Abe.
So yeah.
Many people probably know Abe,
One
but
thing, that is clear is that now, especially with the technology that we've got and the internet being available at our fingertips, is that people of the world can now see exactly what had happened. The people of the world need to continue to bring to light what had happened with these crimes and not let anything be swept under the rug. And people definitely. Certain individuals definitely need to hold accountability for what had happened, because if you do not recognize and take accountability for what happened in the past, then you're doomed to repeat it in the future. So that is it for Unit 731. I know it was a very heavy episode, so I thank you all so much for listening in. Babe, thank you very much for helping me out with this. It was definitely a lot. So if anybody has any comments, anything that they would like to add on, something that I possibly got wrong, please feel free to let me know. You can reach out at manicmannerpodcast@gmail.com if you want to do email. You can also reach out on YouTube, as well as Facebook and Instagram, Manic Matter Podcast. So until the next episode, thank you guys for listening, and we will see you in the next one. Okay.